Welcome to Open Mind UFO Radio. I'm your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I am here with Martin the Spartan Willis.
Spartan, yeah.
You
I've
like
been
it?
Called worse. Well, yeah.
Good, good, good. I liked it because it rhymes. I've been intending to use this for quite some time, and I'm happy to have finally gotten the opportunity.
Wow, yeah.
I'll and it sounds like you are, too.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess let's get into it. So, of course, you're here for news, but right off the bat, before I forget, because I always forget at the beginning, to tell people who my guest is.
Right.
So, I don't know if you got emails from this guy's publicist, James Abbott, but I've been getting quite a few, and which I like, you know, because when the publicists tell me about a new UFO book, because then I get to check it out, and it's fun. Because often there are authors who have never really kind of done anything in this arena before who will write mm-hmm. a book, and then they're fun to interview. And this was a great one. I love this interview. James Abbott, he's in the UK. He wrote a book called The Outsider's Guide to UFOs. And he calls it Volume 1, Mystery and Science. And so we talked to him about this book, and this guy's great. I love this guy. I think you would love this guy, too. He's, you know, just very grounded, and his position was, you know, essentially, which we'll talk about, is just kind of more awareness to all of this. And we'll talk to him more in the interview, but you can get his book, The Outsider's Guide to UFOs, on Amazon, and he's a cool dude.
When you say Volume 1, you must have asked him if he has a Volume 2 in the works, or...
Yep.
Yeah.
I sure did.
And more of that will be heard later.
Exactly.
All right.
So, yeah, real fun. Good stuff. And then, who do I have next week? I have somebody exciting next week. It was something exciting going on, and I can't even remember who it is or anything. For some reason, we couldn't talk this week, but... Oh, well, we'll see. Oh, yeah, we'll see. We'll see. We'll talk more about it. But you are, of course, here to talk UFO news with me. And so let's do that.
I think I am. All right. Well, this story is actually a follow-up to a story that you did way, way long ago, back in 2011. That's actually when I started my podcast back then. But anyway, the headline is Roswell crash site. Let me start that again. Roswell crash site debris may be confiscated. I'm having a hard time moving my lips or something here.
It's your tongue by getting in the way, I think.
Something like that, yeah. By BLM, says a researcher. So the BLM stands for Bureau of Land Management. And this is the researcher who discovered the peculiar material at the site where many believe an alien spacecraft crashed at Roswell. Now, he is a high school teacher. His name is Frank Kimbler. He teaches geology and other earth sciences, and high school and college level, at the New Mexico Military Institute in Roswell. So when he first arrived in Roswell, in that area, he thought it would be a good idea to look at the crash site like so many other people have. He did, satellite images to try to find out where to go exactly. And it's interesting. He did find some medals. And if you go back to your article, when you broke the story back in 2011, you know, he did all kinds of research, isotope ratio tests done. and things like that. I think he even had Bigelow involved in this. I didn't really get a chance to read that earlier article. But anyway, the Bureau of Land Management is, you know, they're not really confiscating, but they're asking to see the material. And I know that this actually has to do with the historical laws of things being, 100 years old or older and considered an artifact. So, I mean, this could be metals from who knows how old, and it's kind of a gray area whether they consider it an artifact or not. I don't know how they can actually age something like that. So he's looking to get all kinds of publicity, and he hopes that, this thing, these materials are not confiscated. He still thinks that he's going to be able to, have them scientifically tested. And he believes they're possibly an unearthly origin. And what do you got to say about all that, Alejandro?
Yeah. So that story, this is a story actually, luckily, we broke. Because Frank, I knew from Roswell because I go there every year. I was helping the city do their conference for a while, and then speaking with the museum and then the newspaper. And now this year, in just a week and a half, I'll be out there, or 2 weeks, about a week and a half, I think. And I'll be out there at the museum doing a talk, and we'll have a table and everything. So people come and join us. That'll be a lot of fun. And Frank will be there as usual. So, yeah. So, I met him in Roswell. And I remember he said that he had these medals and he showed them. It was kind of the secret thing. You mentioned Bigelow. And I haven't really written much about Bigelow because before I got involved, he had met and talked with Chuck Zukowski, and they kind of did a little bit of research before they wanted to really kind of release the story. Then he came to me to release the story, and they had asked Bigelow, and Bigelow showed some interest in doing some analysis, but Bigelow, he's very upset with his group because they kind of didn't take it that seriously, and they kind of said, we don't think it's that interesting, and they kind of blew him off, even though, they had sent them some material, and they assumed that they were doing some analysis, but it took them forever to get back to Frank and Chuck, and so both Frank and Chuck are still very upset with the Bigelow group over that, and it doesn't sound like they were treated, very nicely, but Frank did get a test done through I think it was through the University of New Mexico, but it was in conjunction with the Roswell Museum. And that first test was an isotopic ratio test. Of course, a few weeks ago, I was talking about isotopic research stuff with Chris, the guy who is working with MUFON as their director of research and then left. I think had him on your show. Mm-hmm. And I'm very sorry.
He's upcoming, actually, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cogswell, is that his last name?
Yeah, that's it, Cogswell.
Yeah, great guy. And he kind of talked about some of the particulars when it comes to isotopic research. And a lot of that's over my head. But essentially, it's the only test that you can kind of use to figure out if something was made off-planet or the materials come from somewhere other than Earth. And he... essentially, this first test said, yeah, it was probably unearthly origins, which was really interesting, but it was still within its area of potential error. However, I guess it was way on the outskirts of that. So it's rare that this testing lab, errors to that degree, if ever. And so that's why it was a very strong indicator. And so Frank has sought to do more testing. I've been involved with that. And, there has been some weird, and unfortunately, there's a lot of the background I can't talk about and who did what and when. But there's been a lot of weird stuff that has happened. And it's been really, really difficult to get more testing done. But there is some headway being made. Again, this is unfortunately something I can't talk about, but there is headway being made, and it's looking very positive. So as he said in this article, he feels, you know, he's on the brink of demonstrating that this is something peculiar, odd, that it may be ET in nature. And of course, that would be a big deal. So that's why he's freaked out. He's really freaked out that the Bureau of Land Management is going to take this stuff. I don't think they will, because, like you said, it has to have some sort of cultural or historical significance. Currently, right. It does not. It's certainly most likely, I mean, it's not over 100 years old. And the only way it would have any cultural or historical significance is if Frank is ever able to demonstrate that it is something unearthly, for instance. And so they should let him finish his testing. And that's what I've told Frank, is just let him know that. And I think others who are helping, just let him know, you know, let him finish your testing, have them let you finish testing, and then, you know, keep them appraised of what's going on. But the law is the law. I mean, if it does turn out to be something significant, it's, if we have proof of that, you know, them saying, oh, this is culturally significant, so we need to take charge of it, then just confirms that you do have something significant. So,
right. Well, for one thing, aren't those tests, like, very expensive to have done?
They're very expensive. There's only a limited amount of labs that do them. And often with these things, you know, there's a lab that will do the analysis, give you the data, and then you have to have that data interpreted. And each ends have to be, you know, at least if you're going to demonstrate, if you want to demonstrate a credible, you know, anomaly, each end has to be credible. So many times there has been in the past, unfortunately, people who have gotten tests done, but then they're analyzed by people who are less than credible and whose essential analysis is very dubious. And unfortunately, I feel that that second leg has been an issue in the past with materials such as, you know, the alleged alien, you know, implants that we don't have credible analysis on the follow-up, and that needs to be, that's just as important as the credibility of the lab that does the work. So, yeah, so it's very complicated get all this done and to have it taken seriously and to figure out if it's actually demonstrating something significant. You know, I've been part of many of the efforts that with Frank, and it's proven to be difficult, but there is headway being made. So, you know, he's very freaked out by this, essentially, and he's like, that's why he wants the press and all the notification. He wants everybody to know, just in case it goes bad on Monday, that hey, these guys are doing stuff they shouldn't do. They're taking stuff from him that they shouldn't be taking, especially right when he's on the brink of a potential discovery that would be important.
You know, a similar case, you know, Ray Stanford had was at the Socorro case. And when Hynek left, he was poking around and found a rock that had like metallic a scrape on it from where the landing gear came down from whatever the vehicle was. So when he had it tested, he was very, you know, he was trying to be really, really careful. It was tested over at Goddard in Maryland. He said, please do not scrape it all off. Just scrape a little small part of it off. And the person that he was working with no longer would talk to him. By the time he got the rock back, it was completely cleaned off. Gone.
Wow.
So yeah. Who knows what that was. But another thing, I just want to a follow-up on this particular story is, you remember at your conference back in February, you had Dr. Bob Gross, a great guy. He was one of the speakers. He has a new theory of what he thinks these, you know, what happened at Roswell. I had him on my show recently and had quite a follow-up of email and I don't want to say hate mail, but, you know, a lot of people were, it was very controversial. He was saying that he thought that the country was developing these Sataloons, and they're basically Mylar, PET, a precursor to Mylar with aluminum coating, like aluminum coating around the entire Mylar. And he thinks that's what crashed in Roswell and why the stories came up, you know, with what they saw in the debris field and all that. But there's a lot of holes in it. And that's what I'm getting a lot of feedback from. Still, a couple of blogs written. Kevin Randall actually wrote a blog talking about the evidence that Bob was using. So, you know, it's another theory. There are so many theories of what happened and what a bunch of twists and turns Roswell has had from the beginning. Well, not from the beginning, since 1980 or whenever it came out again.
I feel like there are a lot of things that I feel that Roswell is not, but I don't know what it was, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, I really have personally, there's no significant evidence that points in one direction, but the hard part is there's anecdotal information that points in several directions, and that's the hard part, because if you subscribe to one theory, that theory is likely based on anecdotal information, and other theories out there are also based on anecdotal information. So if you're saying my evidence is anecdotal, how can you disregard other anecdotal information, especially when some of the other information is just as credible? So it's a really tough one. I feel that the Air Force did an awful job in their reports, and their reports are not really to be taken that seriously, because I think they're terrible investigations. I've read these things and looked through them, and they're interesting because they do show that there was a cover-up. A lot of people don't know this, that, you know, it was not a weather balloon. And even one of the scientists who worked on the Mogul balloon, he said, it appears that, you know, they lied, that they tried to cover up the Mogul balloon, if that's what it was, because it was a secret project, but they didn't have to cover it up. I don't know why they did that. It really wasn't that big of a secret, and there were papers and information out there about Mogul, so it wasn't a big secret, so they didn't have to change out the material and show a material at that, you know, in those famous old pictures. That was not what was found on the ranch, which kind of created the conspiracy, and that's in the report. He said, I don't know why he covered it up. It seemed like he was trying to. I'm not sure why, because our project was not that secret. People knew about it out there. So it's another twist and turn out there that's difficult to explain, but you're right. Oh, I did want to mention, too, what's interesting about this. Like, if you go to Open Minds, you'll see in the headlines on the right an article. That says UFO crash site tours to begin soon on New Mexico Ranch. That is the article which created all of this problem, actually, because some of the conference organizers, for whatever reason, decided to do tours of the crash site, which mostly has been kept secret, where people have not wanted to show people to know, so they don't go up there and wreak havoc and create a mess. Well, BLM, because it is on BLM land, and normally you can't hold events or do, you know, without permission of the BLM. But so BLM read that and was like, what, you know, what's going on here? Got a hold of the organizers and said, hey, you guys can't do this. And one of the things they said is, well, Frank goes out there and he gets stuff all the time. Why can't we, type of thing? And that's what alerted them. So they kind of inadvertently threw Frank under the bus a bit. And so that's what created all this headache. So they then got a hold of Frank and said, okay, let's, you know, these guys just told us about you. Why don't we meet? And we want to see what you're doing over there. So I think they're just, like you said, doing their due diligence to figure it out. I don't think they're going to take anything because, as Frank has demonstrated, even with their own material, he's not breaking their rules at all. And so I don't think they're going to want to. And I'm sure they've heard some feedback from ufologists now or UFO enthusiasts, because his story's kind of gotten out there. So I don't think they're going to want to take anything, but they're going to probably want to see what he's up to, and they probably will want to then be apprised of developments in his research.
Right. The one argument that I always bring up on my show about Roswell is, why on earth would the Army Air Force in the first place even come out with the headlines that they found a crash disc or a saucer or whatever? You know, I mean, that they could have just said nothing. It that just doesn't make any sense. And, you know, Dr. Bob had a story for that. He just said they wanted to create the hype to have this thing mysterious, whatever it is. But, I mean, they could have just said nothing at all is what my argument is. I never understood why they even said anything.
Yeah.
And it's not like everyone in the town of Roswell knew there was, you know, that Max Basil was going around and, you know, talking about.
Yeah. I agree. It's a weird one. I mean, it is strange. It's worthy of, you know, of notoriety. It is worth, it's a mystery that is yet to be resolved, that, you know, there's a lot of weirdness around. I you know, a lot of people say, Roswell, I'm so tired of it, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And the mystery hasn't been solved. The new information does come out periodically, and especially as technology develops and we can re-examine some of the potential evidence. And so, yeah, I don't think it needs to go away until we figure it out, and we haven't figured it out. So it's interesting.
It is. It is also interesting, all the theories and how jumbled up everything seems to get. And,
yeah.
You know, you see it firsthand because you go out there every year. You see kind of the mythical part of it, where, you know, the tinfoil hat part of it as well, that all gets mixed in, and it almost becomes a fairy tale.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And then, yeah, it gets difficult. And then poor research makes the whole thing look less incredible when, you know, things like the Roswell slides fiasco happen. And so it's just, yeah, it's really wild. It's a wild world we're in. But, you know, one thing to note, the Washington Post wrote a story recently that UFOs are now a serious subject. And the second part of that was, and you have this rock star from Blink 81 or Blink 182 to thank for that, of course, referring to Tom DeLonge. But just a confirmation that at least this subject is getting taken more seriously. So we'll see. Hopefully people look at things like this a little more closely. And I did want to mention also, you know, I'm writing for Den of Geek, and I've got a story on the Nimitz case. Now, you may be familiar with some of it because, you know, you and I have talked about it quite a bit. But the addition in the story is, first, it's outlining the occurrence that we have from these leaked documents of what happened in 2004 outside of San Diego when the Nimitz carrier strike group encountered a UFO. But also, I did talk to Leslie Kane, Luis Elizondo, and Jeremy Corbell, who's been in contact with the jet fighter pilot who chased this thing, essentially. And essentially confirming those documents, because some people were doubting them, and getting a few comments from them. So I kind of outlined that. Mm. So that is some new information. That story's done very well over there. So you can see a link to that also on the front page of openminds.tv, or just go to Den of Geek and check it out too. But we're almost out of time.
We are already. I can't believe it.
I know. Wow.
Oh, so I didn't have thought you just mentioned David Fravor, right? Isn't that who?
Yeah, David Fravor is that pilot. Yep. And Jeremy does have a new interview. I think he just posted it maybe yesterday with David Fravor, because Jeremy Corbell has been talking to him quite a bit. So Jeremy's doing some really cool work.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
Very interesting.
I've been trying to reach David, but have not. He lives right near me, too far away.
Jeremy's got a great connection with him, but he really doesn't want to do much in the way of UFOs. So,
yeah, I figured.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us for the news, Mr. Willis.
You are very welcome.
Martin Spartan. And we'll be right back after this break with Mr. Abbott. So I am happy to welcome for the first time to the show, author, you're out there in the UK right now, James Abbott. Hello.
Hi, Alejandro. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Yes, thanks for being on the show. So where are you right now?
In Yorkshire, in England.
Oh, okay.
Fairly sunny evening.
That's good. But I'm sure you probably don't have as much sun as we do here in Arizona, which is frying us to death at this time. The second longest day, I guess, this would be of the year, probably.
Yeah, it's going to be really hot out there, I guess.
Yes. So you've written a new book called The Outsider's Guide to UFOs, which sounds very interesting. And I guess to start off, what do you mean by outsiders?
Okay, outsiders are those people who haven't yet made up their mind on the UFO issue. There's a whole load of people, as you know, who are either one decided one way or the other. They're either absolute ufologists and they believe and they study them. Most of them are very good scientists, by the way. And there are skeptics, some of whom are good scientists. But I wanted really, because of the years of reading UFO books and books on science and aerospace books, that the outsiders, the people in the middle, the people who really don't understand what's going on, they're the people that need something to read which is reasonably balanced, which puts the facts before them and says, as I do in the book, you know, here are 40 cases that are extremely plausible and credible, and, you know, read it and make your own mind up.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things you do is tackle that term, because there's so much baggage that comes with the term UFO. But for you, what is a UFO?
Nobody knows. I mean, that's exactly what it's all about. Nobody knows. They're unidentified flying and or swimming objects. And the fact is that they've got such a bad name over the years, thanks mostly to muck being thrown at them by various authorities, that the name has come to be a term of abuse. But really, what we're talking about here are things that simply cannot be identified. We're probably talking about somewhere between 1% and 5% of everything that's seen in the sky.
Right. So, and I think that's important, because I feel that it's important to make that distinction also, because there is a kind of misrepresentation of the term on both sides, from the skeptics, and I think the baggage and the perception that comes along with the term often, you know, is one of the things that kind of makes them hesitant to get involved, or at least to consider the topic. And then there are those on the other side who are the quote-unquote believers, or who want to believe I think that X-Files poster is addressing, who you know, define a UFO as an alien spacecraft, when in fact, when the coin was termed, and as you've just described, we don't know. It's an unidentified object.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are huge reasons to think there's something there. I mean, I started off as pretty well skeptical about the whole thing. And I mean, that's starting off a long time ago with Donald Kehoe's book. But the whole subject is a very, very fascinating mystery. But it is still a mystery. It's not something that we should be making our minds up about either way. I mean, we have to keep open minds after all.
Mm-hmm. And you yourself are certain that it is a credible mystery.
Yeah, it's a very credible mystery. We're talking about, I think there's a body of proof, which I call a body of a priori proof, which justifies further scientific research into the phenomenon. And it is a huge body of proof there. The circumstantial evidence is huge. The witness evidence is huge. The way that people describe these things over 70 to 80 years of seeing them in the sky is very, very similar. But we simply don't know what they are. We have no idea what is happening. It could be that every single one of them can be explained by advances in, I don't know, meteorology or physics or whatever. But somehow there is something there that still needs explained. And it is such a large mystery. I mean, we're talking about something in the order of 2 million sightings globally since the turn of the century. And of those sightings, probably about 50 to 100,000 sightings will be, at the moment anyway, inexplicable.
Mm-hmm. I think that you make a lot of great points there, but kind of getting back, it seems odd even that a scientist would say there's no such things as UFOs, especially when we discover new things all of the time. Certainly, there are things flying, objects flying that are just yet to be identified. It doesn't necessarily mean there's something extraordinary, but they are something that is not identified. However, I probably because of the baggage, it seems that many of the, you know, like you said, the skeptics who are supposedly scientific, who aren't necessarily, you know, go there. I mean, to say for that there is no such thing as a UFO is sort of saying we've identified everything that could be flying.
Yeah, that's my point. I think exactly in a nutshell. General Sanford put it absolutely perfectly a long time ago, you know, way back in the press conference after Roswell. He said a lot of people have reported incredible things, and it's been reported by reasonably credible people. And I think that's what's happening to us. We are getting a lot of witness evidence. We may indeed have some physical evidence, but we're not sure about that at the moment. But a lot of witness evidence, and a lot of it is extremely credible. So where is the argument for not investigating that further?
Mm-hmm. I love that point, too. I love that saying also about, you know, highly credible people witnessing some incredible things. I guess getting back, what is your background and how did you start to get interested in this topic?
Oh, good grief. My background was I started in aerospace for what was then the British Aircraft Corporation, doing contracts for Concorde and Tornado aircraft and so on. And I've always been interested in aerospace, always done research in the area and been working in it for probably the past 30 years. So that was one thing, but as a kid, I liked space stuff and I started reading. I think my first book was Donald Kehoe and my second book was Edward Ruppelt. And the way that those guys put it made me think, you know, you can set them aside and say, okay, these guys are just out to make money. They've published books after being in the military. But when you start putting together all of the various witness statements from various places, like Ruppelt does in his book, I mean, he covers a very small part of the whole phenomenon in the 19, you know, up to the early 60s. And he doesn't actually ever come down on one side or the other, except in volume two, of course, where, or his second edition, where he says they don't exist, which is a somewhat strange thing to do at the end of a book on UFOs. But I think I'd been interested in it ever since then, and I've read lots and lots of books on the subject. I've talked to people about it, and I just got fed up really with all of the bickering that goes on between the two sides. And really, we shouldn't be talking about ufologists and skeptics. We should really be talking about scientists and zealots, because there are zealots on both sides of the argument who think that the whole thing is an absolutely proven case already. But in the middle, I think there are a group of scientists, and those scientists range from people who are almost convinced and would like to know a lot more, to people who are almost not convinced and would like to know a lot more. But that's what's good. That's what science is all about. It's about finding out about things that are unknown. And in the book, I give this example about rocks from space. You know, back in the 16th and 17th centuries, the ordinary people, especially in Europe, were reporting rocks that fell from the sky burning. And the natural philosophers at the time, the scientists at the time, said, no, that's absolute rubbish. You cannot get rocks that fall burning from the sky. How on earth do the rocks get up there for a start? So they've got these peasants lined up in front of them. They say, come on, tell us, how do they get up there? And the peasants say, well, we don't know. Well, there you go then. They can't get up there. You know, try and lift one. And anyway, how do they burn? We use rocks around campfires to stop other things burning. So how on earth do they burn? So that was the story from science for a long time about rocks from the sky, until the 18th century, when a German called Chadley actually worked out how it was happening. And it was happening because he said the rocks were coming from outer space, which, again, a lot of scientists at the time fell about laughing. And for 40 years, he was derided and thoroughly segregated from the rest of the scientific community because of his belief that rocks could fall from the sky. But eventually, a huge meteor shower fell on France, and the French Academy of Sciences sat up and took notice. So did the British. And together, they managed to work out how it was all happening. So suddenly, meteors and meteorites were mainline science. And these peasants that had been utterly derided for centuries were now right. And the scientists walked around trying to pretend that they always thought it was right in the first place, but they didn't quite have the right explanations. But you see what I mean? It's about derision for something that you don't understand. And we're in the same position with UFOs. We simply do not understand them. But what we do understand, Alejandro, is that there are things in this universe, and more things in this universe that we simply do not understand, and that run against logic. And a lot of what the skeptics will throw at UFOs is what they call common sense and logic. They'll say, you can't fly faster than the speed of light. You can't have these things here. How on earth did they find the planet in the first place, in the middle of a billion stars in a billion galaxies? And so on and so forth. It's something that, you know, it's logical arguments against something that is illogical, something that floats, something that wobbles, something that flies in right-angled zigzags. So it's not difficult for the skeptics to knock down those sightings. But the fact is, we just do not know what they are. And it's about time, I believe, that science actually stood up and took notice and started doing some serious research.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me that many of these skeptics are astronomers, and especially in astronomy, they are discovering on a regular basis things that they never thought could have existed. You know, they're seeing these things. We never thought anything like this would have existed, but they do, and they're observing them and finding them, yet they're so rigid about these sort of topics.
Yeah, they are. At least most of them are. I think there are scientists who are prepared to talk and discuss about the fringes of science. I mean, string theory, for example, was heavily derided and ridiculed by physics for a very long time. And I have a physicist friend who works in Cambridge who had a very hard time actually for a long time because he worked on string theory. Now, nowadays, it's just about respectable to do that. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's coming out of string theory at the moment is one of the solutions to the problem of dark matter. And what it actually comes up with is the fact that dark matter is an entirely different type of matter. So it's matter exactly like the desk that you're working at the moment. It's exactly like the screen that you're probably looking at. It's that sort of matter, but it doesn't react with anything that we know. No, none of the electromagnetic spectrum, and certainly only gravity that it reacts with. Well, if there can be something as weird as that in the universe, you know, surely there's room for us to think that in a billion trillion stars somewhere, there may be some other life.
Mm-hmm. you know, you had talked about Ruppelt's book. I say it Ruppelt. I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing his name right, but I agree with you that, you know, that book is one of the most important. And like you, Kehoe also were some of the stuff that I read that when I first got into all of this. But it seems like that was a time where the topic was at least early on taken more seriously. And certainly Ruppelt took it seriously. And of course, Donald Kehoe, both people in the military. And for those of you who are not aware of either of these people, Google them and read their books, some of which you can find for free online, because it's really important stuff. But it feels almost that... like what you're sharing, the perspective of your book, feels a bit novel in today's times, but it shouldn't. I mean, it's an approach that, you know, any sort of mystery, how any mystery should be approached. But we've lived through this time, it seems, where the zealots, as you put it, on either side have just kind of been lobbing, you know, this wild kind of speculation back and forth. And it does seem like, probably because of this information that came out in December, that we're moving more towards a more grounded approach.
Yeah, I really hope that that's true. It's the December announcements and the videos gave me great confidence that things were beginning to crack. And I think that you dare to dream, I think, that UFOs will become mainstream. But I don't think it's an impossible dream. I think it's the sort of thing that is beginning to happen. You can almost feel the atmosphere changing. And I've noticed it particularly over the past, even just the past couple of years, with friends and contacts in this country and so on, that originally I would talk to and I would ring somebody up or get rung up by somebody, and we'd start talking about UFOs. And at first they were extremely skeptical. It was like talking about the Loch Ness Monster or fairies or ghosts or whatever. Now I think I get a call from journalists and they will be much more ready to talk about the possibilities. They're not willing to come down either side. I mean, journalists love to ridicule UFOs because they use the UFO story to get readers, but then they ridicule them just to protect themselves. And it's a very cowardly approach. I've told several people that. You know, if you're going to write about UFOs, then write about them seriously and take the matter seriously, because the people who see them, 9 times out of 10, these people are honest, ordinary people who are just as baffled by the whole thing as you and I. They want to know, though. They want to know what's happening. And they're not afraid of the truth. It could be that there's nothing to it whatsoever. And they're quite prepared for that. They want that to happen. They're not just looking for an excuse to wear a foil hat. Mm. What they want to do is to be told what's going on. And I mean, there was I think it was the University of Arizona one of their associate professors did a survey recently, which showed that something like 90% of the people he talked to were willing to be told what he called the worst case scenario, which was the most shocking psychologically to people, which was that aliens do exist, that they have visited Earth, and that, you know, they're all around you. So if people are prepared for that psychologically, if they're willing to contemplate a future in which that sort of paradigm shift is going to happen, then why not start it? But then I guess those videos could also be seen, and I've said this as well, they could also be seen as part of the acclimatization process.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel there is evidence that there is a process like that occurring?
There's no direct evidence, I don't think. I mean, John Alexander might tell you a much better story about that. But I think the way that things are going at the moment, there is evidence that it could be going on. Mm-hmm. And one of the pieces of evidence, of course, is suddenly your Department of Defense becoming very altruistic and allowing three very credible videos to be released, together with, you know, a tacit nod at Commander Fravor giving giving interviews about the subject.
Mm-hmm. Right. It seems like at least an allowance of the conversation. And what's interesting is we've talked about how there have been these credible people kind of in the closet about these topics, is that that ongoing, as Ruppelt wrote in his book, there have been those in the Air Force who do believe that this is a credible area of study that should be pursued. Yet certainly PR people have felt otherwise. And now it seems that at least those who do feel it is a credible pursuit are kind of having their day.
Yeah, I believe that that has changed, and probably what has something to do with it is a different security situation and a different amount of knowledge that we now have about the phenomenon. Because when Edward Ruppelt or Ruppelt, or yeah, I do apologize to him.
Oh, no, that's okay. I'm not even sure I'm saying it right. So,
right. I have great admiration for that guy. I think what he was living through was a period of incredible stress and tension. And so were the governments. And I know that both in England and in America at that time, we were pretty well worried about what the Soviets were going to do and how they were going to do it and whether they'd captured more brilliant German scientists than we had. So everything that was happening in the sky was first interpreted as a possible security threat. And everything, of course, that in Ruppelt's book was about that problem, about trying to distinguish whether these things in the sky were a security threat or not. Gordon Cooper, of course, you know, when that thing landed at Edwards Air Force Base and the film was taken of it by his men, and he had to send all the stuff off to headquarters, that was why, really. It's because they just didn't know what it was, and they hadn't got a clue. So I know this is probably not a very common theory, but my theory really is that governments are as baffled about this as we are, but they can't show it, simply because that's never done. Governments aren't there to show weakness. Mm-hmm. So they have to keep it under wraps. And what you could find is that somewhere in the United States, there are piles of photographs and videos and bits of evidence and everything else lying around in cupboards and filing cabinets around the place. But nobody knows what to do with them, because they can't let them out because they fear that people would panic. And they can't, and also, of course, the mere act of letting them out would be interpreted by the UFO community as disclosure. Mm-hmm. So suddenly the government was coming clean on this thing, whereas it wouldn't be, really. I mean, what it would be is what the Department of Defense did in December, which is releasing some evidence which they don't understand. They had a long, that ATIP program lasted for 5 years or whatever it was, probably is still going on under a different name. Bigelow was involved. His scientists couldn't work it out. And Lou Alexander was saying that they got close to understanding what might be the cause, what, you know, might be behind UFOs, but they can't actually get there. And the reason for that is probably that the science is beyond us at the moment. Mm-hmm. And that wouldn't surprise me at all.
We do have to take a break, but sure. I agree with you that on both parts, that first it's an unpopular opinion, but it's also my working theory that they're just as baffled as well. And you outline the same reason. So I agree with you there, but we've got to go to break. We're going to be right back with James Abbott, and we've got a short commercial break. For those of you listening to the podcast, you'll hear some music, and we'll be back momentarily. Welcome back to Open Minds UFO Radio. I'm your host, Alejandro Rojas, and we have author James Abbott with us. And I was curious what inspired you to write this book, just because you've kind of mentioned how, you know, it's such a taboo topic that, you know, you're straining relationships, or at least certainly opening yourself up to many awkward moments by taking on a project like this. What inspired you to do it?
Well, I think, as I said, I really got a bit fed up with the battles between skeptics and ufologists, the constant mudslinging, and the sterile arguments about, you know, I saw something, no, you didn't, yes, I did, no, you didn't. The way that I see it is that it's about time. I mean, this book is just a book, and the idea behind it really is to engage people. What I'd like to do, and I would regard it as a massive success, is if the book managed to convince some of the middle ground people to actually read about UFOs and take them seriously enough to read an account like, I don't know, you know, Norman Muscarello's account at Exeter or something, and understand that that was a real human being, a young lad who was placed in a position that was way beyond his experience and understanding up to that point, and it frightened him. Now, once people start to understand that, I think they do start to take the issue a bit more seriously, because there is this weird predilection for people to believe that everybody who talks about UFOs must be a complete nutter.
The Exeter case, and this kind of gets to what was going to be my next question, is what you feel are credible cases. Maybe you can kind of describe it in a nutshell and why you feel that is a credible case.
Well, it's a credible case, I think, because not only did a young 18-year-old lad encounter strange lights on his way home one night, it was early morning, lonely road, there were lights to one side that were very bright, illuminated all the farm and the trees around it, and they were slanted at an angle and flashing sequentially. Now, it's important, that bit about flashing sequentially, because the thing, whatever it was, he said, came towards him, frightened him, he threw himself in a ditch. And to cut a long story short, he managed to get to a police station. And the desk sergeant said to him, when he came in and said, look, I've seen a really weird object and it frightened me to death. He said, that doesn't surprise me, because a lady earlier on reported the same thing. So he allocated a police officer to go with him in the patrol car back to the site and just see what was going on, basically. So Norman Muscarello went back to the site, and the police officer saw exactly the same object. In fact, it came towards both of them again, and it frightened the police officer so much that he drew his gun. Similarly, another police officer from yet another station and area turned up, and he saw it as well. So that's three witnesses, two of whom are police officers from different stations, and the young lad, Muscarello, all saw it. Also, a lady on the same night was frightened by an object that came along above her car, stopped above her car, and that's the important part of it. It stopped above her car and then shot off. Now, that case is incredibly compelling.
With the UK, your government, they've also had quite a legacy of UFO research, and arguably, yeah, I think, much more open than our own. How do you see the UK's approach differs from the US?
I think the British are a lot better at keeping things under wrap. I know you say it's a lot more open, but it's actually not. You know, Nick Pope encountered one side of it, I think, when he worked with the Ministry of Defence, and he was on part-time on the UFO desk, and he did a good job by writing his books. And that's brought a lot into the open, but the British government almost never ever says anything openly about UFOs. And not only did that, but they've squashed UFO stories over the years in the same way that they've been squashed in America. I mean, in 1950, for example, at Farnborough in Hampshire, one of our most famous test pilots, now this guy was absolutely at the cutting edge at the time. He flew an aircraft called the Ferry Delta at over 1,000 miles an hour in 1953, I think. Now, he was one of the top pilots. He actually went on to work for big US aviation companies. And he saw an object which he described as being like a discus on edge. And it was in the air above the airfield. It flew above him to disappear. And it had lights on the edge of the object. Flew over him at 1,000 feet, and he said it was about 100 feet in diameter. Now, a week later, he and some colleagues also saw a similar object, but it was a long way away, and it was in the air, and it was fluttering. It was descending and fluttering. And he reported that. And in spite of all his judgment, all his eyesight, and the fact that he was corroborated by other people, the government wrote it off as a mirage, and he was sidelined. So he shut up and shut up for the rest of his life, really. So, yeah, the British government does have experience of these sort of things, but they do exactly the same as the American government.
Mm-hmm. Very quiet and hush-hush.
Definitely.
Is it well known out there that the royals have had quite a history and interest in the topic?
Yes, it's pretty well known. The tabloids will often run a story about how Prince Philip believed in UFOs, or Earl Mountbatten believed in UFOs, or you know, there are, you know, Lord Hill Norton. It's not that he's a royal, but he was a senior officer and very close to the royal family. The stories are well known, but then, you know, I can point just down the road here to Leeds, and I've got about four or five different people who've seen pretty credible UFO sightings, and the one lad saw something and filmed it just recently, a guy called James Goldman, whose videos were online and in the papers over here. It's very much treated as the silly season story, the sort of thing that the papers will run when there's nothing else to do. Or if it's big enough, if it's grand enough and it's colorful enough, then they'll put it on the front page and sell a few extra copies.
And I guess with your book, are there cases or points in particular that you're looking to get across that you feel have not been, you haven't read this in other books, or is not something that is being discussed currently, which you think it should be, including cases or otherwise?
Yeah, I'm not so sure about the cases that are in the book are what I consider to be 40 of the best, the very best, most credible cases. But what I think is very interesting is the commonality between UFO sightings and what I call the strange characteristics of UFOs. If you think about it, there are things about UFO sightings that are just weird if you're being logical about it. People see UFOs and they say, well, they hover. Well, how many times have we in our mythology, and I know David Clark is big on mythology and mythology as being behind the whole thing, but if we were following a myth, if we were following the films or the comic books of the 40s or whatever, we would not be having silent hovering objects in the sky. And there's the lights. Why the lights? I mean, Philip Klass brought that one to the fore, didn't he, when he said, why the lights? But it's true. You know, why on earth do these things have so many lights? And if you wanted people to believe you that there was an alien being flying, you know, millions of light years across the universe to get to you, and then they scream into the Earth's atmosphere at high speed, swoop down through the clouds, and when they get down to within about 100 feet of the ground, they stop but wobble. And the wobbling has been reported by lots and lots of different people. It was reported in Exeter, in the Hudson Valley. It was reported in Operation Mainbrace in the UK in 52. Kenneth Arnold said they skipped like pebbles over a pond. This whole thing about unusual movement for me is one of the keys to this problem, because people would not report that if they really wanted to be believed. What you'd report is something that was loud, growling, some sort of, nowadays you'd report something like a Death Star or a freighter of some sort that was coming through the atmosphere. But people don't. They still report these silent, bright lights or hovering objects. Mm-hmm. For me, that's really compelling.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting about that as well is that because it's unexplainable, that's often one of the things the skeptics point to, is, oh, well, they wouldn't do that, which I always think is interesting, because how would they know what they were doing? How can we even begin to speculate about their motivations or their modus operandi, or even how their technology may work?
Yeah, precisely. And I think it's that point really which undermines the whole of the skeptical arguments, I think, because this is a mystery which I don't think we're going to solve very easily, because the science, if it is some sort of scientific engineering object that's coming to us, then the science behind it is so far in advance of us that we've got a lot of catching up to do. I mean, I think you've had Lou Elizondo on the show, I think, haven't you?
We with the UFO Congress, yep, I have talked to him.
Yeah, and he was saying, as I believe when I read what he'd said, he said that there were things in the discussion within ATIP towards the end, and within this mysterious report that we still don't have, which get close to how they might work, and it's about quantum gravity, about warping space-time, and so on. And the physicists, I was reading in Scientific American the other day there, that the physicists are actually, you know, getting quite close to understanding how space-time and gravity and all the other electromagnetic forces work together. The only thing they haven't fitted into this nice, neat explanation, of course, is dark matter. They don't understand how that gets fitted in. But if we could do that, then I think we would be getting close to understanding some of the issues which surround these objects.
Mm-hmm. And there are, because again, the scientists talk about the amazing amounts of energy it would take to travel at using some of these methods. But again, there are others who feel that there can be shortcuts around that, where it wouldn't take as much energy as many believe.
Yeah, we just don't know, do we? I mean, it's a bit like scientists back in the 19th century saying that nobody could ever travel faster than 30 miles an hour because it would kill them. It's just nonsense. I mean, what scientists should never, ever be asked to do is to comment on things that they don't have the information or the understanding of to start with. Once they've got that in understanding, then we can say to them, where does that then lead to? But to just say to them, there's a UFO and it might need a lot of energy, and them to say, well, no, that's impossible, that's a bit like rocks from the sky for me. Hundreds of years. Sorry, go on.
Oh, I was just going to say, your publicist had written about how, the recent news about Trump announcing the creation of a space force, and that yeah. You had some ideas around that in relation to UFOs.
Well, not so much ideas around it. I just what I feel is that the Space Force is probably, I mean, it's obviously up to your government to decide whether it's necessary or not. But the idea of it is almost coincidental with the release of the videos to to the public in December. If we're beginning to be a little bit more open about these things, maybe the government is now setting the scene for a more active investigation through what would be a space, a dedicated space force, rather than the US Air Force and its Space Command, which is already in existence. So it's one of those things, I think, that we will have to sort of suck and see. But the whole thing seems a little bit coincidental, and it's part of, it could be seen as part of a process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, it makes me think about, you know, kind of when we're speculating about motives and, you know, how the skeptics can point to this or that characteristic and say, you know, that would never happen. It feels the same way with politics and politicians. It's hard to decipher why they do what they do. And this is certainly a mysterious situation to be talking about making a whole sixth branch. And it appears that these discussions have been happening for some time. So it would be interesting to, and it's interesting to think about what impact that would have on this field. And would this organization perhaps, it would probably be part of their duties to look for unknowns. And, I'm sure, as it is for the Air Force, despite their saying otherwise, a part of their function in that you can't have something flying around in your airspace without looking at it and trying to figure out what it is.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the way the Air Force, got pretty tired of UFOs in the mid-60s when they managed to get Blue Book closed down. And the it's just been dogging them for decades now. And unfortunately, the Air Force has had to take the brunt of the pressure on it. That, well, now I think they may not like the idea of the Space Force, but if it does get set up and if it does get into action in the next few years, one of the things it will have to do is to look at any and all reports of things in the sky or space. And you know, there is some evidence to say that they will find them as well.
We've only got a couple minutes left, and your book is volume one. So what do you hope to tackle in upcoming volumes?
Well, certainly in volume two, what I want to do is, and that's pretty much complete now, it's next couple of months, I would guess, I'm looking at more up-to-date sightings and adding to these 40 credible sightings since the Second World War with modern day sightings in the 21st century and coming right up to date, and also talking about credibility and about a bit about David Clark's theory about the myth and how films and books and comics have influenced what people see, which again is a fascinating idea, and there's a lot to say about that.
I agree with you, because certainly there had to have been an impact, and many UFO researchers or enthusiasts refuse to even look there. But it's important to examine all the data, and that is certainly some of the data.
Yep, it is. Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, on the flip side, it's been the opposite. I do a whole lecture about Spielberg and how he's based so many of his movies off of UFO and or ET cases.
Yeah, and I think that's the key, really, to David Clark's argument. The it's which way round is it? Do films follow reality, or does reality follow film? And the evidence for me points to film following reality rather than the other way around.
Mm-hmm. So you have a website, jamestabbott.com. Is there another place that people can go to find information about you and your books?
Well, most of it is on the website, but I have a Facebook page, obviously, and Twitter and so on, so people can come on there and have a chat. There's masses of stuff going on at the moment, so there's lots to talk about. But mainly the information about the book itself is on there, and it's available through the normal channels and obviously Amazon in digital, paperback, and hardback.
Well, I've very much enjoyed this conversation. I'm I can't wait. I'm fascinated about the book, so I want to look through it. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And in the future, especially when you get that second volume out, we'll have to have you on again.
That's great, Alejandro. And thank you. It's been a pleasure and a privilege being with you.
Thank you so much to James Abbott for being on the show. That was really cool. I think his book is going to be fascinating. I think that's one of the things that is great about this topic becoming less taboo or more mainstream, is that there are more credible people coming out of the woodwork to be involved with all of this. What's interesting is I think that the old schoolers, the people who have been in this for a long time, get frustrated by that because they feel like people are kind of encroaching on our territory. I personally welcome it because the more minds, the more we can take a look at this and figure things out. And that's what this is all about, to me at least. Anyway, James Abbott sounds like great. He's a great addition to our community of UFO researchers. And I'm greatly welcome him. And this was a great interview. So thank you very much, Mr. Abbott. Be sure to check out his website and get his book. Otherwise, I do want to say thank you to everybody that we saw at AlienCon and also some of my new readers at Den of Geek. So Den of Geek, it's a cool site. Go check that out if you haven't had the opportunity to. They've been posting my stories, and I know the editor I've worked with, who I've worked with for quite some time, I've just met him at different press things, he's very excited about this topic. But some of the owners and some of the head dudes were a little bit hesitant about adding the UFO aspect to the website. But of course, people are fascinating. So the stories have done very well, and luckily they felt that, I've been able to bring a credible look at this phenomena. And right now, of course, there's some extraordinary things going on. So check those out when you have a chance. It really helps, I think, this topic, because we're bringing, all of this to a new audience, and they get tons and tons of hits. It's a very popular site, and mostly, of course, people who are into sci-fi and all of those type of things, which if you are into sci-fi, which I'm sure many of you are, there's a lot of cool analysis and everything about some of the shows that are out now. You can find out some of the different shows, including Westworld. I'm really into Westworld. So last night, of course, was a season ending, and it was mind-blowing, really cool stuff. I love that kind of stuff. Sci-fi is my favorite. It makes you think. It makes you think about the possibilities, and a lot of it is brainstorming, the kind of things that we talk about on the show on a regular basis. But what's fun about introducing this to the sci-fi community is a lot of them don't know about the real stuff going on out there. So they're fascinated when they hear about it, especially related to some of this cool stuff we have going on now with Elizondo and everything. And we do have an article coming up in the Den of Geek magazine that gets into just how weird and crazy all of this investigation with the DOD was. Because as we talked about with Jeremy Corbell, it's a lot stranger than many think. By the way, Jeremy Corbell, you can check on my Facebook or, of course, his. He's done some great interviews, including a new interview with David Fravor, one of the jet fighter pilots. Also, T-shirts for the UFO Congress. We got a lot of really cool T-shirts and styles that you're not going to find anywhere else that are from our amazing artist, Eric McFarlane. So go check those out when you have a chance at UFOCongress.com. And then I want to thank, of course, the people involved. So thank you to Martin Willis of Podcast UFO for helping us with the news. Thank you to Caleb Hanks for the opening and close music. And thank you, of course, to you, the audience, for being here all the time. I apologize for having shows on an irregular basis, but I'm afraid that I've got just so much going on here and there that it's going to have to continue like that for a while. But I do plan on having a show here next week. The following week, I'll be in Roswell. So come and say hi at the UFO Museum if you're going to be there. You can also check out some of our cool UFO and alien t-shirts. We'll have some of those at a table there in the museum. Until then, I hope you all are having a wonderful summer. Adios, muchachos.